Imagine a London alehouse in the summer of 1717. The air is thick with the smell of coal smoke and roasted wheat. Near the towering shadow of St. Paul's Cathedral, men from four different lodges gather, not just for fellowship, but to attempt something entirely new.
And that attempt changed the course of Freemasonry. Welcome to the Johnson City Lodge Masonic History Briefing. I'm Brother Archivist. My job is to guard the record, check the sources, and be clear about what we know and what we don't.
And I'm Brother Orator. I help turn that record toward its meaning, context, and the memorable lessons it holds for us as Masons. This Masonic historian agent was built by Dr. William Fisher, a Master Mason and proud member of Johnson City Lodge No. 561, to help share careful, engaging knowledge about Masonic history.
Our purpose is simple: to help brethren, prospects, and Texas history listeners explore Masonic history with curiosity, care, and source humility. You can learn more at JohnsonCityLodge561.org or send questions and source leads to jclodge561@gmail.com.
This week, we have one central story, the day the idea of a Grand Lodge took form, and what that means for every Mason, from an old London tavern to the Texas Hill Country.
Let's start with the record. On June 24, 1717, St. John the Baptist Day, four London lodges met at the Goose and Gridiron Ale House. The United Grand Lodge of England, their direct institutional descendant, identifies this meeting as the formation of the first Grand Lodge of England.
It's easy for a date like 1717 to feel like ancient history, something distant and disconnected from our lives here in Blanco County. But the structure born that day is something we live and breathe in every stated meeting.
That's a crucial point. Before this, lodges were largely independent, self-governing bodies. Their connections were based on shared custom and mutual visitation, but there was no central authority to ensure regularity or continuity.
They were solving a fundamental problem. How does a local craft preserve trust across time and distance? How do you know if a visiting brother is truly a brother? How does a lodge prove its own legitimacy? The answer they devised was the Grand Lodge.
This created what we might call the operating system of modern masonry. It's built on several key pillars. A lodge must work under a charter from a recognized Grand Lodge. It must have elected officers, keep records, and hold annual communications with that Grand Lodge.
And through that relationship comes recognition. Our Grand Lodge of Texas recognizes other Grand Lodges, and they recognize us. That's why a Texas Mason can travel to a lodge in another state or even another country and be welcomed as a brother. That chain of trust started at the Goose and Gridiron.
The structure also includes dues, discipline, and organized charity. These weren't new ideas in themselves, but centralizing them under a Grand Lodge gave them a scale and permanence they lacked before.
Exactly. This isn't just administrative paperwork. It's the framework that allows our principles to endure. That framework proved so effective that it crossed the Atlantic.
It did. English warrants, which are charters granted by that first Grand Lodge and its successors, were instrumental in establishing regular Freemasonry in colonial North America. The St. John's Grand Lodge in Massachusetts, for example, was constituted as a provincial Grand Lodge in 1733 under the authority of the Grand Lodge of England.
And that same pattern, that same operating system, eventually made its way to Texas. When Masons here sought to form a Grand Lodge during the Republic period, they weren't inventing a new model. They were adopting a proven system of governance that guaranteed their legitimacy and connected them to the wider Masonic world.
So Johnson City Lodge No. 561, working under its charter from the Grand Lodge of Texas, stands in that direct line of descent. Our lodge's authority and regularity trace back through the history of our Grand Lodge to this very principle of organization.
This is why a London tavern belongs in a Texas Lodge history series. It's not about borrowing someone else's nostalgia. It's about understanding the very foundation of our own lodge life. We meet as local brethren face to face, but our work is framed by obligations, records, and a system of recognition designed to outlive every single one of us.
This also explains my particular focus as Brother Archivist. The 1717 meeting underscores why Masonic history is so dependent on written records. Grand Lodges preserve minutes, charters, proceedings, correspondence, and lodge returns for a reason.
Because the craft is more than just a warm memory of fellowship. It's a governed body whose continuity must be provable. Trust requires proof. Recognition requires a record.
When a lodge secretary carefully records the minutes, when the treasurer keeps the books, when we honor the terms of our charter, we are participating in the core work that began when those four lodges decided that local practice needed a durable, verifiable sinner.
So, what are the key takeaways for us this week?
First, the formation of the first Grand Lodge in 1717 was a practical solution to a real problem: how to ensure stability, continuity, and mutual trust between lodges. Second, this model became the essential structure for regular Freemasonry around the world, including in Texas.
And third, and perhaps most importantly for us today, every act of good governance in our own lodge, from keeping records to paying dues, is a direct echo of that foundational commitment to a craft that is both local in its heart and universal in its principles. It's a legacy we inherit and a duty we uphold.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Masonic History Briefing. We hope it gives you a deeper appreciation for the structure that supports our craft.
Until next time, from all of us at Johnson City Lodge No. 561, travel safe, and may you ever meet upon the level and part upon the square.